Good evening, friends. It is really my pleasure to invite you all here to an evening with His Holiness Radhanath Swamiji. And at the outset, let me thank each and every one of you, because I know so many of you all have left so much behind just to be here with us today. I know people have left weddings, people have left dinners, people have left cricket matches, hockey matches, and so much more. So I know those who are here really want to be here and have made a real effort. I thank you all. I think Radhanath Swamiji needs no introduction, but for those who are actually meeting him or hearing him for one of the first times, I think I should say a little bit. Swamiji, as many of you all know, that he is one of the leading Swamijis of the ISKCON movement, and he is also the celebrated author of The Journey Home, which is a book, an autobiographical book, which Swamiji has written about his early life, which has inspired so many people on the path of spirituality. And this book is available for those of you who haven't got it or haven't read it. And at the end of the evening, you're most welcome to pick up a copy and read it and know what Swamiji's early life was and what has made him what he is today. And just to be very brief on that, Swamiji started his life as a young Jewish boy in the city of Chicago, swanky city of Chicago. And 40 years ago, when he was just 19, he was inspired by a burning desire within to do something more with his life, to do something out of the ordinary. And truly, having kids who are 19, who have passed 19, I just realized that at 19, children aren't even inspired to do, they don't have a burning desire to do anything. And Swamiji, at that time, he left the luxuries of his home, he left the comforts of his home, and he decided to come hitchhiking all the way to India. Penniless, without any money, without any comforts. So he came all the way through from London by boat, by land, by jeep, by bus, by trucks, risking his life with his most perilous journey, which I think most people would have given up on, wouldn't have even made it here. But something inspired him, and he felt his calling to come to India, because he felt he would learn something there and he would be able to give something there in due course. And so he came to India, he crossed the borders, and he is here with us today. And at the border, when he was stopped, because he was a foreigner, he was penniless, and at the border they said, "We don't want any mendicants, we don't want any beggars, we have enough of them, please go away." But the promise that he made to the officer at the Husseiniwala border of India and Pakistan, he said, "Please, sir, please let me in, because one day I will do something good for the people of India. I promise you." And he's really kept that promise. And there is so many things that Radhanath Swamiji has done. He has started the hospital in Mira Road, the Bhaktivedanta Hospital. He started the hospice in Vrindavan. He has initiated the midday meal program, which feeds 12 million children across municipal schools every single school day. He has many initiatives, including rural eye camps and so many more, but I don't want to go into each of them. But what I do want to say is that with all these projects, he has inspired ordinary people. He's inspired people like us to do something more with our lives, and which is why personally, me and my family are completely indebted to him, because it's because of his inspiration, it's because of his guidance that our lives have changed, and I feel they are much less ordinary than they would have been. And now we feel we have a purpose, we have an aim, and it's all thanks to Swamiji. So on a personal note, I thank you, Radhanath Swamiji, for everything that you've done for us. And today I wish that he shares some of this magic, he shares some of his learnings and his teachings with all of you, so you understand what I'm speaking about. And today I've asked him to speak on purification. And this is a topic which I feel all of us, in some way, we're trying to get closer to God, we're trying to get more spiritual. But without these shuddhis or purifications, we somehow don't make the cut. So what is it that may help us to achieve, to be more spiritual, to achieve our spiritual goals? So I have requested Swamiji to speak on the shuddhi, the purification of the mind, the purification of our wealth, and the purification of our soul, which he has been guiding us. And you will probably at the end of it see how it all links up to all Swamiji's projects and how he's inspiring people to get involved in them. Thank you for being with us. I hand it over to Swamiji. And also I wish to also say that Mr. Kalyan Raman from the US, who was supposed to be with us, has cancelled his trip. As a result, we won't be hearing from him, as I had mentioned to some of you. And if you're wondering how Mr. Kalyan Raman fits into this the whole scheme of things, well, Swamiji's story was from Chicago, leaving an opulent life and coming and being a mendicant in India. He doesn't have a bank account. He's not had a bank account since I think 1969. He has no money. And Kalyan Raman's story was quite the opposite. He was from the streets of Chennai and thereafter Mumbai, without even an address for his first interview. And he went to Chicago and he made it big, and the rest is history. But how the two connect up is Swamiji is Mr. Kalyan Raman's mentor. So we thought perhaps after Swamiji spoke, Mr. Kalyan Raman could, you know, share a few insights. But he's not here with us today. Maybe some other time. So over to His Holiness Radhanath Swami. Thank you.
It's my honor and my pleasure to be with you this evening. Thank you, Nupur, for your gracious and kind words. Thank you to this wonderful family, the Desais, who have opened the doors to their beautiful home for us tonight. And I thank all of you for coming despite the cricket and hockey and everything else going on. I was asked to speak about being purified. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Of purifiers, I am the wind." Tonight, we are feeling the nice ocean breeze. There's also a beautiful verse, "Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu," that Krishna is an ocean of kindness. And the breeze of that kindness actually permeates everything, everywhere. And we become purified through the natural process of just tuning in to that grace that is coming from the ocean of God's kindness. I just met Mr. Mishra, who is from Jagannath Puri, and just a few weeks ago I was in Puri. In one early morning, I was doing my meditation of chanting the Maha Mantra to get purified. And I was praying for a nice inspiration. And I looked out at the ocean. And there I saw a fisherman. Very simple little rowboat he had that was big enough for one person. It was early morning, the waves were very high, and he was trying to somehow or other get his boat out where he could go fishing. And I was watching, and he took his boat and he went, and a big wave went and knocked him down, and the boat tipped over backward and went to the shore. And he picked it up again and pushed it into the water and started going with the boat, pushing it on his feet, and another big wave pushed him back. And he was really struggling, and somehow or other he got into the water where he actually got on the boat, and then another big wave came and knocked him over. The boat went tumbling. He went into the water. He got back on. And finally, when he came to the deep water, it was very peaceful. And then he started doing his fishing. So what was the inspiration of that, since I don't eat fish or anything like that? That to live with values, to live with spiritual integrity, to actually make that inner connection to God or to who we call Krishna is very similar to what that fisherman did. In the beginning stages, when the mind is still very conditioned and oriented toward selfishness, greed, arrogance, envy, selfish passions, they come like waves on us and try to push us back. So it takes some determination. Not only determination, but faith. You see, that fisherman, he knew. He had total 100% faith that if he just kept trying, he would get to those calm waters and catch his fish. Through satsang, through association of people who are enlightened, or people who have faith, not blind faith, but realized. Realized faith built on the foundation of a philosophy, tradition, and the direct experience of others and ourselves. That gives us the impetus that, yes, if I just keep trying, I will receive that place that I'm trying to find. But wave after wave will come. And actually, I could see he was enjoying going through it. It was a struggle, but he was enjoying the struggle because he knew where he was going. So similarly, when we have that faith through Shravanam, Kirtanam, through Satsang, then we know for sure where we're going. And we know for sure the power that's within us that will actually empower, that will enable us to reach it. And then even the struggles give us pleasure. One time a little baby was crying, and a mother had to jump up from the class that I was giving and take her baby out so the crying baby wouldn't disturb people. And I asked her afterward, I said, "I'm really sorry, that must trouble you." She said, "No, it's a pleasure." Even if that baby cries all night long, it's a struggle. But because I know I'm helping someone I love, it's a pleasure. So real happiness is not just the immediate pleasures to the senses and to the mind. The real happiness everyone is seeking is fulfillment of the heart. And that only can be connected to when we satisfy the essential need of the heart, which is to love and to be loved. If we don't have people who love us, and we don't have anyone to love, then all of our so-called happiness in this world is very superficial. It cannot reach the heart. Why? Because that is our nature. Janmadhyasyayataha. The Vedanta Sutra tells us that the source of everything, the source of our very life, the absolute truth, Bhagavan, Krishna, who has many names, God. Love for God is our innate nature. And when one loves God, it is like watering the root of the tree, the Bhagavad Purana tells. That water naturally extends to every part of the tree, the leaves, the flowers, the branches. And because God is the source of everything, Jagannath, the Lord of all creation, is the source of everything and everyone, the father and mother, aham bija pratapita. Then when we connect with that love by experiencing the infinite love of God, who is Karuna Sindhu, and reciprocating with our love, then our love reaches every living being in the form of compassion. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was one of the great saints of our tradition. He was actually the guru of my guru's guru guru. He lived at the time of the British regime in India, in Bengal. He was married. His wife, Bhagavati Devi, was a great saintly lady. They had 10 children, several homes. And he was a magistrate in the British legal system. And he was such a good magistrate, so thorough, and so compassionate, because he really was a saint. Even Babaji's and Sadhu's and Swami's would come to hear him speak and receive his blessings, because he had such love, and it manifested through compassion. When he would be in a courtroom, and he would rule somebody guilty and send them to prison, usually that person would thank him because he was such a compassionate person. They would have faith by being in the courtroom with him. If you're sending me to prison, that must be the best thing for me. There's not too many judges like that anymore. He was a saint. He also lived in Puri. So this principle of compassion, Bhaktivinoda explained, when love of God is actually tuned into within our hearts, it naturally expresses itself as compassion to all beings. Because when we connect to our own true identity, which is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss, we are the Atma. We're a part of God. Then we recognize that everyone, wherever there's life, is a sacred part of God. And then our greatest joy is to express our love through compassion. We were speaking today at the Young President's Organization that when this is our motive, how enthusiastic and determined we will be in whatever we will do. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was a warrior, the least likely occupation to be a saintly person. But that was arranged just to show whatever occupation we're in, it has the potential of being yoga, a means of purification, the actual path of liberation. Whether we're in business, or science, education, agriculture, politics, whether we're swamis, housewives, mothers, fathers, whatever. If we do it with that, after tuning in to that divine essence within us, that bhakti, then our occupation and our activities become dharma. That's the true meaning of dharma. To unite whatever we do in whatever role we may be in with our spiritual nature in the service of God. How to purify our hearts to actually make that connection. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who lived in Puri for about 18 years, he spoke a beautiful verse. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Satya Kabunoi Saravanadi Sudichiti Kodiya Yudvai. That eternal love for Krishna, for the one supreme source of all religions, is within the heart of everyone. By taking to a spiritual practice, by associating with spiritually minded people, this love is awakened. Satsang is where we connect, like events tonight, especially for the purpose of nourishing our spiritual side of life. And it's a sacrifice. To get here, like that boatman, you had to go against the waves of cricket matches and hockey matches and so many other things that were trying to keep you on the shore. But somehow you came. Satsang is so very sacred because it gives us inspiration and faith of what is within me, what is my potential, what I can do for this world. And then there's sadhana, where through this faith, we appreciate the value of our spiritual side of life. Because we have a body, and we have a mind, but we also have ourself, who's experiencing through this body and mind, the living force, the true me. And all three aspects need nourishment. And a balanced life, a life of yoga, a life of true religion, is to appreciate the needs and to cultivate and nourish our physical health, our emotional health, and our spiritual health. And to help to do that for others as well. Because ultimately, the body dies. Nahanyate hanyamane sarire, but we never die. So before that time comes, to make that connection is to actually find a treasure that is not limited by the waves of time. And that's truly what everyone's looking for. That love that is unlimited and unending. Why are we looking for it? Because it's who we are. It's what our nature is and what our greatest potential may be. So sadhana is to take some time to actually purify the mind. Mantra means to liberate the mind from arrogance, greed, envy, selfishness, illusion, envy, to free our minds. Cheto dharapana marjanam, the mind is compared to a mirror. When the mirror is covered with dust, that's what we see and that's who we think we are. All of these material conceptions that are being perpetuated day after day becomes our idea of who we are. But when we cleanse the mind through these mantras, through our prayers, through our spiritual practice, we can actually see who we really are. And we can reflect that grace, that brilliance of our true identity, that love, in everything we do. Our wealth, because we accumulate so much. Our wealth may be knowledge. It may be skills. It may be money. It may be fame or power. That's all considered wealth. In the Bible, Jesus says, it's easier to put the camel through the eye of a needle than for a wealthy person to enter the kingdom of God. Now, that analogy is quite profound. Putting a camel, actually, not elephant, putting a camel through the eye of a needle. But then afterward, he says, for man it is not possible, but for God all things are possible. Now, in the Bhagavad Purana, Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas, she says essentially the same thing, with the same conclusion that's in the Bible. Janmaishvarya Shruti Shribya Edamanabhadapuman. That the greatest obstacles to spiritual progress are wealth, a lot of money, a high education, beauty, and fame. She said these are the greatest impediments. But if we understand they're only impediments if they bring out this tendency of arrogance and greed, and envy, because that's often what happens when we become attached to these things. But if we understand the simple principle, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam Sarvalokamaheshwaram, Krishna tells the peace formula, the easy process anyone can attain peace is just to understand three things. That God, or Krishna, is the proprietor of everything. That means we are the caretakers of sacred property, to be used for a sacred purpose. And everything is meant in a spirit of service, samsidhyat hari toshanam, to harmonize our body, mind, words, and life in such a way that we're pleasing to God. Pleasing to God means being of service to God's children. Isn't that what pleases any mother or father? And recognizing that ultimately God is the supreme object of our love. And we are the supreme object of God's love. If we just harmonize our life in this way, it becomes very simple. So our spiritual practice is to connect to that essence, sadhana. And Lord Chaitanya has told us that through chanting these mantras, through our spiritual practice, giving time, giving importance to these things, gives everything else we do a divine purpose. I write in the book I wrote on the journey home, when I was a young boy, I heard Martin Luther King. He said, if you don't have an ideal you're willing to die for, you have nothing worthwhile to live for. And in those days, in the 1960s, I was a teenager, it was a very unbelievable disconnection in America between the young generation and the older generation. In certain ways, we were at war with the values of our parents. It was called the counterculture. So Martin Luther King was very influential on all of us because we saw so much racism and hatred in the name of the ego that I'm white and you're black. I wanted to find that ideal. And I tried to find it in politics, and I tried to find it in the counterculture. In social activities. And ultimately, I heard Gandhi say, you should be the change you want to see in the world. And I understood that that change has to be spiritual. If I can make my ideal to find out who I really am, then whatever I decide to be, whether I follow my father's path to be a businessman, which he always wanted me to do. But now he's happy I'm not. Or whether I go into some other field. Before I left America in 1969, I worked as a cook in a hospital. So I was thinking, maybe I should be a doctor. But whatever it is, unless I find that ideal, then what do I really have to contribute? So that's what led me on this spiritual expedition. And renunciation is not being a swami and living without a bank account like me. Renunciation is just understanding to whom everything belongs and learning to live in a spirit of compassion, in a spirit of service. To learn in a spirit, to live in a spirit of love. And in my own life, it was revealed to me that I could best serve in that way as a Swami. So that's what I am. To give time, to nourish that inner wealth that we have is so important. And then we understand that our wealth, by utilizing it in charity for the purpose of compassion, our wealth purifies us. Wealth is sacred and purifying. It's the essence of Dharma when it's used in compassion. To earn with integrity and to spend with compassion. And this ego of I am this body and all the designations of this body and whatever is in relation to this body and mine is mine, that ego is purified through seva. To really appreciating the value of service. What my guru Srila Prabhupada taught, which was so beautiful, was there is nothing more valuable than the opportunity to serve. The evolution of human nature is to progress from the obsessive need to get things to the joy of giving for the body, mind, and souls of others. That is seva. Ravana, he wanted to enjoy by taking Sita to his little island, Sri Lanka. And Hanuman, who was actually the son of the wind god, Pavana, Pavana Putra, with his strength and powers, he just wanted to bring Sita back to Ram. They were both intelligent. They were both powerful. They both had the exact same facilities as the other, as far as their strength, their intellect, and everything else. But Hanuman used it in a spirit of seva, and Ravana used it for his own selfish purposes. Now, the Gita tells us that these two tendencies are within each of us. Our lower tendency and our higher nature. Like two dogs living in our hearts, good dog and bad dog. The good dog wants to satisfy its envy, its arrogance, and its selfish passions. And the good dog is our humility, our gratitude, our will to serve with love, with compassion. And they're both calling for our attention. Sometimes one barks louder than the other. And we have the choice. Sometimes that bad dog is really barking, demanding our attention. And sometimes the good dog is very quiet. The one we choose to feed is the one that's going to rule over the other. And that means the choices that we make. Our potential is so beautiful. In my own life, I've witnessed most incredible miracles. just by someone seeing our potential. Do you all know what a hippie is? In the 1960s, hippies were, my guru, Srila Prabhupada, he was in San Francisco in 1967. That was the, 67 was the summer of love, where people from all over America came to become hippies to revolt against the establishment in Haight-Ashbury, a division of San Francisco. And they were really, like, so many were free sex, free drugs, free everything, free from taking baths. They were really just speculating like anything what freedom was. So Prabhupada was there with them. And he was asked by a newspaper reporter, Swami, what is your interpretation of what a hippie is? And Prabhupada said, because he was then 72 years old, and just a year and a half before he came from living in Vrindavan, at the Seva Kunj, Radha Damodar temple, he was living in the heart of Vrindavan where Krishna and Radha have their Ras Lila. He lived there for about 8 years as a sannyasi, a swami, totally immersed in that holy place. And in the early 60s, Vrindavan was very quiet. Now it's very developed. Even when I was there in 1971, it was so quiet. There was only one other white person in the whole Braj Bhumi besides myself. And it was forests and cows and peacocks and parrots everywhere. And the monkeys never bothered anyone because they were happy in the forests. If you take the forests away from them, then they become kind of like people in the ghettos. You almost make them into thieves by putting them in poverty. But it was so beautiful. And Prabhupada left there with no money, the age of 71, to go to Haight-Ashbury, to live with hippies. Not to get anything, because he had nothing to get. Just wanted to give. So they asked him, what is your interpretation of a hippie? And Prabhupada looked at the newspaper reporter and smiled and said, you know better than me. Because he was an American. And then Prabhupada said, something extraordinary. He just couldn't believe human beings living like that, coming from the culture he was from. And then that reporter said, can you show me a miracle? Because swamis are supposed to do miracles. Prabhupada said, my miracle is I have made hippies into happies. How did he do that? I saw before my own eyes how he transformed thousands and thousands of lives from people who were ruining it with drugs, aimless, revolution, anarchy, to really becoming deeply pious, moral, living with very high integrity, loving God and wanting to share that love with others. What a miracle. But how did they do that? Because Prabhupada saw something in them that they had forgotten existed. Yes, I can make a difference in this world. Yes, I can connect to the all-beautiful, all-loving, supreme truth, or Krishna, or God. Whatever name. Yes, I can make that connection.
And I could be an instrument of that love. I could realize a happiness beyond birth and death, and I can share that through whatever I do. That's my birthright as a child of God. It's just that we forget it. Just a few days ago, I was at Oxford University, and I was asked at the Oxford Union to be a part of a debate. And the person I was debating against was Dr. Cornel West, who's from Princeton University. And I'd love to tell you about that, but that would take a long time. Because in the process of debate, we agreed with everything each other said. The Oxford Union is really a very unusual place, because in that union, when they have a debate, this was the biggest program they have in the whole year at Oxford University. It was the 50th anniversary of when Malcolm X, have you heard of him? He debated on a subject which is very relevant today. Is extremism in defense of liberty a vice? He argued it was not a vice. It was justified. And Cornel West, who's an African American, who's on television almost every day in America, and who's a great scholar, he was taking Malcolm X's position. It's not a vice. And along with him was Angela Davis, who was one of the most famous radicals of the 60s and 70s, African-American lady. She was so radical, so influential, and such a powerful speaker, the FBI claimed she was one of the 10 most dangerous people to America. They put her in prison. She was such a radical person. She was in prison for a couple years. She didn't even do anything wrong. It was just to intimidate her, to shut her up. And the day she came out of prison, she went to Cuba to meet Castro. Very bold lady. She was along with Cornel West to defend the argument it's not a vice, extremism in defense of liberty. And I was invited, but until I got to Oxford, they didn't tell me which side I was on. So when I got there, I found out that I was on the side of it is a vice. And I had to argue against them. But I had one other person on my side, a lady named Shami Chakravarti, who's like a very powerful person from Newsweek, I think. But she didn't come. The last minute, she didn't show up. So it was them against me. And my God, what kind of argument he gave. Cornel West, he was before me. Before then, do you want to hear this story? It's actually interesting. First two students argued it. And this one, they're from the debate club of Oxford Union. And my God, were they passionately ripping into each other, trying to defeat each other. So I thought, God, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then Cornel West, everything he was saying, he was getting ovations and he was getting cheering and people were clapping and stomping their feet. And except for me, every single man out of about 450 people in the Oxford Union chambers, every man was wearing a full tuxedo. It's a very formal event. And every woman was in extravagant evening gowns. And I was wondering, where do I fit in? So after he speaks and he gets all these cheers, it was time for me to speak. And I began by saying, if you ask a Swami to come to a debate, whatever side of the debate you put me on, I'm just going to say what's in my heart. And I spoke my heart. Would you like to hear some of the things I said? I said, what is extremism? It's very subjective. There were people in high political power who considered Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King to be dangerous extremists because they were boycotting the economic system. That's extreme. They were breaking existing laws, and they were subjecting to their followers to brutality. At the same time, there are people who do not consider it extreme that there was the strongest possible military action to liberate surviving prisoners of the Nazi concentration camps. Then I quoted Malcolm X because I read his speech. And there was one paragraph from his speech that I really could connect to, because I had to find something. He was a very radical person in the 60s and 70s. 60s, actually, because he got assassinated 2 months after he gave his speech at Oxford in 1964. He said that in order to understand whether extremism in defense of liberty is justified, one cannot look at the subject as an American. As an African, as a European or an Asian, one must look at it from the perspective of a human being. All men are created equal. That's the first principle of the U.S. Constitution. That's the basis of democracy. That's the basis of humanity. It's the essence of every religion. The Gita tells that real wisdom is to see not only all humanity, but every living being with equal vision, because everyone's a part of God. Life is sacred. So I said, I want to argue today from a spiritual perspective that arrogance that causes us to be so obsessed with proving ourselves superior to others to the point that we create hateful ideologies that oppress people, that is extremism. To the very heart of humanity. Then I argued against that, and I quoted Bhagavad Gita. And after I spoke, Dr. Cornel West, who was my opponent, he jumped. This is something I think never happened in the hundreds and hundreds of years of the Oxford Union and all their debates. He jumped up right in front of all these people in their tuxedos and in the evening gowns, and he ran up to the center of the room where I was standing and embraced me and kissed me and said, I agree with everything you said. And I said, actually, I agree with everything you said too. Because it was just on two different levels. He spoke brilliantly. So this higher ground of what our real potential is, Srila Prabhupada could see that in us. And he gave that, his recognizing that, yes, you are a divine child of God. You are eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. You are perfect. There's no reason to be depressed. There's no reason to be arrogant. There's something very sacred that you have that you can connect to. And that's, Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. That he descends into this world again and again in different religions, in different forms, in different avatars, just to remind us of who we really are and what our real potential is and where our real happiness lies. In the love that's within our own hearts, which is inseparable from our own souls. To tune in, to connect to that. And then with all determination, enthusiasm, to be instruments of spreading real compassion in the world, in whatever we do. So when I was watching that person on the fishing boat. After a while, he was in very calm waters, just putting his net in and bringing up so many fish, and he was just so happy. But to get to that place, he had to endure some obstacles. From his perspective, it was worth it. And what we have the opportunity to receive. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Your Holiness Radhanath Swamiji,
thank
for your
you.
Very kind and enlightening words. And now I request, if there are any questions from the audience, I will pass this mic over to any of you. And in addition, if you all are shy to ask the questions, to stand up and ask the questions, you could even write it down. Jinisha will give the pieces of paper, but if someone is ready, any questions? And meanwhile, just to sum up, very briefly, what Swamiji has said in reply to what I'd asked him to speak about the purification of ourselves, our minds, from all these things which plague us, like envy, jealousy, anger, being judgmental, all these things. So Swamiji has so nicely enlightened us on how the mind is purified by mantra, by sadhana, by satsang. And how the ego is purified by seva, and how our wealth is purified by using it in dan, in the spirit of compassion. So, thank you, Maharaji.
Actually, she told me everything I should say.
No.
Thank you.
And it was very nice hearing about your interaction with
Dr. Connell. I'm your little repeating parrot.
No, Maharaji. Any questions? Would someone like to ask?
Maharaj, I want to understand the concept of yagna, which Krishna talks about in the Gita, in relevance of modern times. Can it be related to modern times?
Yes. It is a timeless principle. But in spiritual truths, according to time, place, and circumstance, how to apply them takes wisdom. The wisdom of the scriptures, the wisdom of saints, and the wisdoms of our own intuition that's, you know, connected in that way. So yajna has many meanings. In one sense, yajna means the homa, the performing of oblations a sacred fire. In another sense, yajna means sacrificing something selfish for something divine. Neglecting the bad dog to feed the good dog is also a form of yajna. Yajna also means whatever particular spiritual practice we may perform. Maybe puja, maybe vandana, prayer, maybe mantra, japa. There's a beautiful verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yajyai sankirtana priyai yajanti hi shumedasha. And in this age of Kali, a time, or let us say a season, that's predominated by the tendency for quarrel and hypocrisy. Cornel West, once when we were having a conversation together at Princeton University, before Oxford, he said something that really inspired me. Because he's a very religious man himself as a Christian. He said, in this world, because he's a professor at college, so he sees what students go through. He said, people are constantly being bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. So our spiritual practices are meant to help us to focus our energies in such a way that we're making progress toward our spiritual goals in whatever we do. So to make those choices are a form of yajna. But in this age where the tendency is so strong toward quarrel and hypocrisy, where there are so many distractions, the simplest, most powerful and accessible of all forms of yajna, sankirtana, yajyai sankirtanan prayai, is the chanting of God's names. Lord Chaitanya, who we believe is an avatar of Lord Krishna, he wrote a prayer, nam namakari bahuda nija sarva shaktis. That, my dear Lord, you have many names that you have revealed in many religions over the ages, and you are personally present with all of your powers, with all of your grace, with all of your love in your names. And there's no hard and fast rules for chanting these names. Even a child could chant. It doesn't matter what material designation our role in society may be. It's so accessible. Whether you're in the bathroom or whether you're on the altar of a temple, you could chant God's name. And we can invoke that grace and be purified by that grace. Lord Chaitanya himself personally chanted this mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and proclaimed, according to the Kali Santarana Upanishad, that it is Maha Mantra, special medicine of a yajna to clean our hearts, to awaken that love within us in this age of Kali. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Swamiji, thank you so much for
thank you so much.
Very enlightening talk. So the question I wanted to ask you was, what is your definition of God? Is the manifestation of our superior self, or when we sort of are able to manifest a supreme state of being, is that God, or do you see him as a distinct entity? And I think the other question that I had really was that God is also really the source of so much strife in our world, and maybe that's also because of the fact that it's misused, but I just wanted to get your perspectives on that, because we just see so much strife in the name of, you know, God and religion.
Thank you.
In the Brahma Sutra, which is the summary essence of all the Vedas, Upanishads, Samhitas, Puranas, Upanishads, it describes at the very beginning, Janmadhyashayataha. The definition of God is the source of everything, from whom everything emanates. And the comparison is given in the Vedic literatures of the sun planet in the sky. The sun planet is the source of all light. And it's also the source of all heat. And nothing can live without it. And the sun rays that are coming from the sun are absolutely non-different from the sun in quality. They give off heat, they give off light. They're of the same substance. And every sun ray is coming from the same source, right? It's not that one sun ray is coming from another place. They're all coming, so they're all related, they're all united. But quantitatively, there's a difference between a sun ray and the sun planet. Because the sun planet is not coming from the sun ray, but the sun ray is coming from the sun planet. And similarly, in the Upanishads, it is beautiful verse, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Eko Bahunam Yobididati Kama. That there is one supreme truth from whom everything emanates, that's God. And there are limitless eternal truths in the form of wherever there's life, there's a part of God. So in the bhakti tradition, we are all those sun rays. We are Satchit Ananda, just like God. We're eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. And what is that bliss? The potency to love with compassion. We're beyond birth and death. That's the nature of the soul. But there are many of us, and we are all connected in our appreciation that we're coming from the same source, who we call Krishna. So Krishna is the supreme object of love, and we have the supreme power to love and to feel loved. So God is the all-pervading energy of the sunshine, but also the form of the sun. The Bhagavad Purana tells in this way, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavaniti Shabjate. There's three principal aspects of that one truth that are revealed throughout history in all the great scriptures. There's the Lord who is the all-pervading presence, which is like the sunshine. The Lord who is personally within the heart of everyone. The first is Brahman. The second is Paramatma, who's within our heart as the witness, our constant friend, if we just turn to him. And there's Bhagavan, who is the supreme, all-attractive, unlimitedly beautiful, loving God, we call Krishna. And the bhakti, the certain traditions of people who aspire to enter into the atmosphere of the unlimited, impersonal aspect of God. Some yogis try to connect with that Lord within the heart. And the bhaktas
want to completely offer our love to the supreme, all-attractive, all-beautiful person of God. They are different aspects of the same truth. And this is one of the things that convinced me to follow this path of bhakti, because I found in it not just a sentimental idea, but a really deep understanding of the unity of all religions, even in their apparent contradictions. That's the first question. The second question is, where there is the ego, ahankar, we can use anything for that purpose, including religion. We could use militaries, we could use philosophy. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, said, philosophy without good character is practically useless. The whole purpose of religion is to help us to transcend the arrogant ego that has such a void that it needs to feel superior to other. If we have a full heart, we don't need to feel superior to anybody, because we're connected to the supreme superior of everything. We just want to be an instrument of that love as a servant. One who really considers themselves the servant of everyone is actually a true master. And one who feels that need to be the master is a servant of their own mind and the servant of their own egos. So religion is given. In the Bible it said, the meek shall inherit the earth. So why do people of that religion have to feel I'm superior to yours? Your religion is bad, mine is good. It's there everywhere. Many Brahmins in India feel like that, and many understand the essence. Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Jains, Sikhs, whatever. If we have an ego and we don't understand the purpose of our religion, then the very wonderful blessing that we have to go beyond our ego, we use that same thing to be a weapon to conquer others for the purpose of our ego. You could use a knife to kill someone, and a surgeon will use the same knife to save a person's life. Is the knife good or bad? The knife is as valuable as the person who's using it. Wealth, money, academic power, scientific discovery, religion, philosophy, they're all like that knife. If we have the proper character, which is the purpose of religion, to develop that humility, that compassion. If we have that proper character, all these things, including religion itself, can save people's lives, can give people such life through love, through compassion. Otherwise, we just use it according to our own uncontrolled egos. And throughout history, people have used religion for that purpose. But that doesn't mean religion is bad. It's the most sacred blessing that we all have if we understand it properly. Because true dharma, Sarva dharman parityajamamikam sharanam raj. True dharma is beyond sectarian boundaries if we understand the essence. Does that answer your questions?
Guruji, first of all, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
To develop this character that you're talking about, I think it's essential, perhaps I feel personally that it is essential to develop it early in life. And how important is it from your own experience to have a guru that makes a difference in developing this character?
The importance of guru is sung throughout the ages in tradition and scripture, because gurus preserve the essence of a spiritual tradition. Otherwise, as we have been explaining, our egos can interpret it in so many ways for our own purposes. So parampara, you know, to present as living examples is so important to us, to actually have faith and direction. As parents, the greatest act of love we can give to our children is to have them inculcate this culture of values, of integrity, of God's grace, of bhakti, because that will give them real fulfillment. It will help them to overcome every obstacle with dignity. Those values are sacred. And it will bring them real happiness and make them instruments of happiness. To give our children material things without that is really depriving them. To give them material things to whatever our capacity is with that is actually giving them something that's a real legacy for the world. Because when we're young, we can imbibe these virtues and these divine experiences before we get subjected to so many bad habits and distractions. Yes, that's the advantage. But because we all are inherently divine, eternal servants of Krishna, parts of God, it really doesn't matter what age. The soul is always young. I've seen people in their 90s who really wasted their life away, you know, in so many distractions, who understood, yes, this is what I want. And I saw them become perfect saints because of the quality of how they sincerely pursued loving devotion to God, to Krishna. So we want to give the best to our children, but for ourselves, it's never too late. It's always the right time if we just do it right. Does that answer your question?
In this age, how do you realize that this is a genuine guru? Most of the time, there are so many frauds around. So what makes you realize that this person can take me on the path of spirituality?
Takes a little education, but in principle, according to our traditions, a true guru is not one who claims to be God. A true guru is one who claims to be a humble messenger of God. I met so many gurus who had so many philosophies, and I liked almost all of them. because I was just learning. It discusses this in the book I wrote. I remember I was in Vrindavan in 1971, and I was sitting, there was just five or six people around Srila Prabhupada. He wasn't my guru then. He was just another one of the saints I was coming to visit. He was just visiting for a few days, coming from somewhere else. And somebody asked him, "Are you the guru for the whole world?" And he didn't say anything. And I was really, actually very excited with anticipation. What is he going to say? Because most people would say yes. And after he paused for a few minutes, he looked down on the ground with tears of humility in his eyes. He said, "No." He said, "I am the servant of everyone. That's all." And I was thinking, he's the guru of the whole world.
Spirituality without the presence of a guru? Can you make the scriptures and what you have learned from others as your goal?
We can make progress to an extent. Because whether we admit it or not, we do have gurus. People who inspire us, people we get knowledge from. But if someone were to approach a loved one who needs bypass heart surgery. If someone comes up and says, "I'll do the surgery," will you want to know where they studied from and who they learned from? Or will you just say, "Okay, if you say you know how to do it, you can do it"? When it comes to something like a heart surgery, we want to make sure that that doctor has been properly trained and knows the right techniques and the right tradition. And that means they went to a medical school. And going to a medical school means they studied under medical practitioners who studied under other medical practitioners who studied under medical practitioners, and they know how to do it. So when we want to do this awakening within our own heart, spirituality isn't such a cheap thing. According to tradition, a guru is one who has actually, you know, studied the proper scripts, lived with a certain character, and who has been a student of others who have taught him or her. Does that answer your question? That's if we really want to go to that, to the depths. Yes. There was one more question.
Swamiji, what comes first, love or trust?
That's a beautiful question. They are like a coin with a head sign and tail side. If you have heads and tails on a coin, it's the same coin. Which comes first? They're inseparable. The depths of real love and real trust are inseparable to each other. But generally, when there is some trust or faith, in Dharma, in the values of Dharma, in people who are teaching Dharma, then that trust gives us the strength and the determination to put these beautiful principles into our life. And from that, love is awakened. But as love is awakened, there's a deeper and deeper awakening of trust. And as that trust gets deeper, there's a deeper awakening of love. But some trust is preliminary, that love does exist within me. And this, there is a way that I can reconnect to it. Does that answer your question? I'm just so happy to be with all of you. I'm so grateful. Thank you very much.
I think with that, we will come to an end of the formal questions. And later, if you would like to speak with Swamiji, he'll be happy to answer some of your own questions. And something that I had forgotten to mention at the beginning, one of Swamiji's very important projects, his more recent projects, and something that he really has his heart into, is the Govardhan Eco Village. And this is a short distance away from Mumbai, where Swamiji is putting in all his energies into rural development and trying to even inculcate in our city dwellers the concept of simple living and high thinking. So sometimes from our busy urban lives, we can have a retreat somewhere we can go and connect to our more simple selves. And with this, I encourage all of you, I invite all of you on behalf of Swamiji to please come and see the Govardhan Eco Village for yourselves. Some very nice work is being done there, where every system is uses its waste products as the input to the next system. So if you see in the entire equation, it's a zero waste system, because waste generated from one system is the input for the next system. So there are so many other things that are being done there, water harvesting and horticulture using no pesticides and going green. And we invite you to come and see it for yourselves. And we thank you, Maharaji, for being here tonight, for blessing us, for guiding us, for just transforming the lives of ordinary people like us into something more meaningful. Always be indebted to you for that.
Thank you for giving such encouragement to an ordinary person like me. Thank you very much. If I can say one thing about our eco-village, we have many different systems there, but one is where every time you flush the toilet, the sewage becomes refined through a natural process of just going through gravity and through solar power, through different herbs and roots and rocks into pure water. And where it goes through, it's pumped through solar power to this little kind of a higher area, and then it goes down through different layers of rocks and roots and herbs, about seven layers, and then it comes out clear water. And if you go up there, it's like a paradise. There's so many beautiful things growing. We have hundreds of papaya trees and all over the property, and the papayas are about this big. But if you go up there to the top where the sewage is being processed, the papayas are this big. So there's a saying there that every time you flush the toilet, the papayas get bigger.
Because usually we flush the toilet and it's like, my God, you know, no, there is no, we don't feel we're accomplishing something positive when we flush the toilet. But people really think, yes, I'm making the papayas bigger. And like that. So some yoga students, some teachers from America, from New York came and they saw that. And they were so inspired. They were looking at the papayas, and they said, these are not papayas. Now, this is not me speaking. This is a yoga teacher from New York. She said, these are poopayas. No, I think that I already said too much.
With that, I once again thank you all for being here, for patiently listening, and now everyone must be really hungry. Dinner is served. Please, I request you have dinner and then pick up any of the books that you'd like. There's Bhagavad Gita, there's Maharaj's Journey Home. Please pick up your copy and thank you for being with us tonight. Good night. Hare Krishna.